This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Everybody knows that the dice are loaded. Everybody rolls with their fingers crossed. Everybody knows the war is over. Everybody knows the good guy's lost.
Visibility's down to near zero in many parts of the northern half of Colorado Springs.
Go!
Along Interstate 25 and area roadways, bumper-to-bumper traffic sitting in a smoky haze as fire crews desperately tried to get to the blaze.
As I begin this program, Colorado is burning. So are parts of Utah, where I was just camping. It's everything we've been warning about on this program literally for years. Climate change has struck. Normal isn't a word we'll get to use again in our lifetimes. In America, 1,011 heat records fell in 1 month. In Coweta, Oklahoma, a kid managed to fry bacon on the sidewalk. Firefighters had to wait for nightfall to even get close to the fires. Mostly, nothing human, not even machines, could approach the towering walls of fire. In Toronto, Canada, it's been summer since April. Millions of people are sweating it out in filthy smog. The NASA map for May shows excess heat all over the world, except for the Pacific Northwest and Australia, which are colder than usual. Everybody else is getting a double helping of 100-degree-plus heat, 38 degrees C in the shade. Globally, it was the hottest land temperature in May ever.
But that record-breaking heat is making it so much harder to fight the fires, and Sam is tracking that. Triple-digit temperatures everywhere.
Yeah, George, you and I talked about this yesterday. Some of the numbers in our country, some of the warmest temperatures in the world. Mecca, Saudi Arabia was 109. Yesterday, we were 115 in Hill City, Kansas. 105 again in Denver, Colorado. Now, never, ever, ever since they've been keeping records. Okay, one time in 1934, Denver got to 105 degrees. Now, back to back, 105 degrees. Houston is already 102 for the day. Colorado Springs at 101. They had never been warmer. Take a look at the heat records expected today and the watches and warnings that are out. There are three states that are completely solidly covered in watches and warnings. And then take a look over here on the eastern coast.
Funny, I haven't heard much from the global cooling guys lately. Nobody is buying those lies anymore, but the usual billionaires plan to stuff it down your throat anyway. In Australia, where climate change has driven drought-stricken farmers to suicide, where roaring fires have killed hundreds, the country's richest woman, Gina Rinehart, is trying to take over Fairfax, the biggest newspaper and television chain that Rupert Murdoch doesn't know. Gina loves climate denier Ian Plimer and wants another denier, Andrew Bolt, promoted to top spot on television. It's a boardroom battle with respected Australians pleading for a little sanity in the daily papers, maybe with editorial independence. Just like the Koch brothers in the USA, billionaires can drag off both media and politics to suit their need to pollute for profit. Maybe it would be a good thing if Rinehart can turn Australia's media into a climate denier circus. It would be the last act of newspaper suicide in that country. Young people whose future are ruined, they know better. They are already moving to social media and the net. Once the big lie is floated in their faces, it could be the end of newspapers down under. Credibility gone. Not that American or Canadian media are doing any better. Covering the Colorado fire story, the weathercasters blow up the horror of the heat and the high winds without ever mentioning climate change. Apparently, they've never heard of climate science. There could be some kind of award to the major TV networks for the number of times they can report obvious climate-caused damage without ever mentioning the truth behind it. Everyone can win that award. At thinkprogress.org, you can find Joe Rahm's excellent summary of the horrible media cover-up. There are links to all this in my blog at ecoshock.info. We'd have to hand out another prize for dumb journalism for every reporter who doesn't know the West is also burning, because the pine bark beetle and other borers killed off entire forests. All those dead trees, they're burning, and nobody mentions this. The pine beetle problem is straight out of global warming. The winters haven't been cold enough to kill off these pests. You've heard about this from me for a long time. Every forest worker, the logging companies, the state governments, everybody knows warmer winters have killed off masses of trees. Now they are burning. What a surprise. The reporters or their editors need to be spanked for leaving that out. Still on climate, extreme rainfall events are coming too fast to report them all. Duluth, Minnesota was drowned out, but how about Florida? Tropical Storm Debbie, not even a hurricane, dropped 5 to 7 inches of rain over 3 days. Towns nowhere near the sea, a lake or a river, were flooded as water erupted out of the ground. Super storm cells washed over the Midlands of Britain. Flash flooding all over England and Wales in the past week, called biblical. We've got some ideas from science about why it burns or dumps tons of rain or snow for weeks, why the weather stalls. Scientists think the melting sea ice in the Arctic has disrupted the jet stream. In his blog, Early Warning, Stuart Staniford has a great explanation of it. It turns out the jet stream, traveling high above the Earth, is bent into oxbow-like waves as the planet turns. In a nutshell, these are called Rossby waves. We have to do a whole radio EcoShock show on them in the future. The Rossby waves used to undulate with some regularity over the northern continent, bringing a mixture of weather systems, including heat, and then cooler periods and rain. Our agriculture is built on them. At a weather and climate summit in January, Rutgers ocean scientist Dr. Jennifer Francis advanced the theory that more open water in the Arctic is impacting these Rossby waves. The result is much slower movement of more extreme weather patterns, and it's called blocking. It's been documented several times since 2007. That may explain the months-long extravagance of heat and drought over Texas and Oklahoma in past years, and the strange summer in March over eastern North America this year. It's wild to think that melting Arctic sea ice could be part of the burning American West. I'll toss a link to the video of Jennifer Francis, her presentation, into my blog at ecoshock.info. Check it out. Be the first on your block to actually understand why the weather is so messed up. Oh yeah, the Arctic sea ice is the lowest ever recorded for this time of year. Right now in 2012, it's lower than the jaw-dropping record of 2007. Of course, you saw those headlines, the big TV news stories about all that? Not. Under the remaining ice, so thin it's almost translucent, scientists have discovered vast pools of algae growing. They've never seen it before. We have no idea how that will impact algae feeders who arrive later in the summer, or why it's there. Normally, and there is no normal anymore, algae doesn't get enough light to grow under the ice.
In what seemed like seconds, flames jumped from the canyon to homes. Tens of thousands forced to evacuate. Shauna Miller had just 5 minutes to pack, shoving clothes, photos, and her three cats into the family car.
I'm so scared. I don't want to lose my home.
But hey, as you're packing up your kids and photos in your 5 minutes to evacuate, the head of ExxonMobil says, don't worry. At a meeting of the Council on Foreign Relations, ExxonMobil CEO Rex Tillerson said global warming is happening, but it's, quote, manageable. He admits burning fossil fuels are causing the climate to change. Too bad Exxon funded so many climate deniers for so many years, saying it isn't happening or humans aren't causing it. Tillerson told the well-connected bigwigs, quote, as a species, that's why we're all still here. We have spent our entire existence adapting, so we will adapt to this. It's an engineering problem, and it has engineering solutions, end quote. Rex Tillerson says we'll adapt. So get busy adapting, because this big oil company needs to keep making billions of dollars in profits every quarter, no matter what.
O heavenly grid, help us bear up thy standard, our chevron flashing bright across the gulf of compromise, standing humble on the rich field of mobile American thinking, here in this shell we call life.
By the way, the nuclear disaster at Fukushima continues to percolate along. Debris is hitting the west coast of both the United States and Canada. Some of it will be radioactive. Canada has no plans and no budget to clean any of it up. Meanwhile, the nuclear operator TEPCO finally sent some workers into the super dangerous reactor number 1. It's been too radioactive to approach, but they got a sensor down where the former reactor container used to be. And what did they find? The highest levels of radioactivity yet. It's over 10,300 millisieverts an hour. That's enough to quickly kill humans, making them sick within minutes. Agence France-Presse laconically reports, quote, demolition of these three reactors, as well as the plant's number 4 unit, is expected to take 40 years and will need the use of new technologies, end quote. That is, new technologies that don't exist yet. The Japanese explain the sky-high readings are due to problems with the nuclear fuel. Problems? Everybody knows the reactor melted down and then melted through its containment as well. Nobody knows for sure where the lava-like nuclear material is right now. Is it percolating on the concrete floor? Will it go through to hit the water table? Or just out into the Pacific Ocean? This isn't over. Stay tuned for the Fukushima cliffhanger. There's two more reactors just like that. Under extreme international pressure, the Japanese have announced they will speed up efforts to remove nuclear fuel rods from the semi-demolished fuel pool in reactor number 4. Radio EcoShock was one of those voices, with nuclear expert Arnie Gunderson warning a collapse of the reactor 4 fuel pool would be a world-poisoning event and near final for large parts of Japan, including Tokyo. Several listeners made that Gunderson EcoShock interview into YouTube videos, which have many thousands of views. When it really matters, the word gets around. And there's more on Fukushima. This week, thanks to a listener tip, I heard a podcast from the Guardian newspaper in the UK. In it, Dr. Bill McGuire, a volcanologist and specialist in quakes and volcanoes, explains how global warming will destabilize the Earth's crust due to three factors. One, in some places, as under the remaining glaciers of Iceland, there exist volcanoes which have been more or less corked by the mass of ice over them. When that ice cover melts, they blow. That isn't the case near Fukushima, Japan. Number two, as ice over 1 mile thick melts in places like Siberia or Greenland, the pushed-down land rises, causing quakes and underwater landslides that can lead to tsunamis. We can't rule this out as a factor at Fukushima. And three, the melted water goes elsewhere in the world, distorting our orbit slightly, but also causing different pressures, especially in places under the ocean where the crust may be weak or cracked or already in transition. Again, I wonder. I have read elsewhere that the sea is not level. More water is drawn to areas with heavy layers of ocean crust, especially to certain types of rocks. Simple calculations of mass draw more water to such places. The sea is more than 24 feet lower in a place in the Indian Ocean where the underlying crust has less mass. It is a couple of feet higher around the island of Japan, where very dense rock under the sea has lots of mass. So Japan attracts more of the glacier meltwater as sea levels rise. Did the added mass of the melting Arctic glaciers help trigger the massive undersea earthquake and resulting tsunami that wiped out the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear reactors? I'll put links to everything you need to investigate in the show blog for this program at ecoshock.info. I'd heard about this human-induced change to geology, but until I listened to that Guardian podcast, I didn't really get it. McGuire says the rapid temperature rise in the Arctic will lead to a period of geological destabilization, featuring volcanoes, quakes, and tsunamis much more than we have experienced. He cautions these will not happen in places where the pre-existing stress points or loose water slopes or volcanoes do not already exist. The global melting will just exacerbate those situations where they do exist and cause them to bunch up in a much shorter period of time. We'll see more surprising and destabilizing events. Geologists and paleoclimatologists have already found several periods of melt-caused instability going back millions of years. We had one period like it between 10 and 20,000 years ago, when the big North American and Eurasian glaciers melted back over a period of about 1,000 years. None of this is good for the nuclear industry, with so many plants built in quake-prone zones or right near the ocean where a combination of rising seas, more violent storms, and increased tsunamis will surely cause more Fukushimas. I could spend the next hour just reporting the warning signs of extreme ecological collapse, leading with the demise of the climate as we know it. Should we just give up? Is there a way out?
This is Radio EcoShock.
This is Alex Smith, and I'm wondering, are we so addicted to bad news, so expecting the worst that we can't even look at a plan to save ourselves? We wonder, are we worth saving? I had to overcome those doubts to hear from our next guest. Daniel Reardon's new book is called The Blueprint, Averting Global Collapse. Well, at least he's got a plan, and respected environmentalist David Suzuki recommends it. Daniel, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you.
Daniel, when we see a good movie, we have to suspend disbelief. You're writing a script for a future that strains our imaginations. Do you really believe we can roll back carbon from the atmosphere, or that wild herds of animals will return to the world's grasslands?
I predict nothing, but I believe it can be done.
Okay, well, on your website, you have selections from your book as videos, and watching those, nobody can accuse you of not thinking things through. Let's start with solar. Instead of a million rooftop panels, walk us through your vision for powering up with the sun's energy.
While this is only one component in my overall energy scheme, this is really the heart of it. So what I'm referring to is the solar power towers, something which already exists in few select locations around the world. It's a very different concept. The idea here is to have a tower surrounded by thousands of large mirror arrays, which are moving and tracking the sun throughout the day. In tandem, all those mirrors reflect the sun rays, directing them to a bank of tubes on top of the receiver tower. Now, the tubes have within them salt. The salt is getting heated by the sun rays, getting to a sizzling 565 degrees Celsius. Then the salt is routed downward to a storage tank. And whenever we need to generate electricity, we route the salt to heat exchangers and we create electricity in the conventional turbine fashion. The importance of this technology is to decouple the time that the sun shines and whenever we need to generate electricity. So we can have electricity generated in the middle of the night just as much as in the middle of the day.
So where does this technology exist?
The first fully commercial plant came online in 2011 in Spain. This is the Gemma Solar. And we have a few larger projects under construction in California.
And do we need to put these big solar plants in the desert?
I would actually advocate that we won't, although technologically it will be optimal. But I'm not advocating any further degradation of nature. So I modeled solar power towers which will be outside the desert proper in places like Colorado, Texas, and the Central Valley in California, wherever I could find the graded land. And it can work there not just as well, but still it can do the trick.
Well, and I guess it makes sense if we can to put these things closer to where the consumers are so that we don't have to have long, long transmission lines.
Here I will have to beg to differ because my plan calls for the entire transcontinental grid so that power generated in the resource areas like the wind regions or the sun regions can serve also population centers in Pittsburgh and Toronto. So actually my plan does call for superconducting cables routing the power to wherever it's needed.
Well, Daniel Reardon, if listeners can't accept your word that alternative energy could do it, maybe they'll believe the U.S. government agency, the National Renewable Energy Lab, the NREL, just issued a new study saying 80% of U.S. energy could come from renewables by 2050, every hour of the day and night, just using existing technology, so it can be done. But, Daniel, as you know, another huge problem all over the world is water supply. Right now, from the plains of India to North America, we're pumping out these fossil waters from deep in the ground, and it's running out in many places. The water table is sinking. How will the world find a sustainable source of water?
The ocean, in a nutshell. Basically, what I'm proposing is to desalinate water of the ocean. And I crunched the numbers, and I'll give you a bottom line, one possible proposal. If we allocate 680 terawatt hours every year, which can be done, we can desalinate enough water, which I reckon to be 50 billion cubic meters, to provide for all the needs of the United States that include not only desalination, but also a system of canals that will pump the water from the shores inland. So with this scheme, we can have water whenever we need, however much we need, and using it without guilt.
Well, how do you work these things out? I'm interested in your method. Do you dig deep into the research? How do you do it?
Yes. It really comes down to the details, isn't it? To the technicalities. So I basically looked at existing desalination plants, and I saw how much it takes to convert to desalinate 1 cubic meter. Then I looked at the Arizona Canal Project, which already moved water around, and I basically scaled things up from there. I also looked at the projected needs of water, how much we're using right now, and I put it all together, and I arrived at the figures I just gave you.
And I was interested to see you included bringing back the herds. We've had Alan Savory on Radio EcoShock as a guest, and now Seth Itzkan has a new TEDx video out about how animals can help us put carbon back in the soil. What brought you to that solution?
A number of reasons, one of which is what you just said, but that's not the main one. Nature for me is an end in itself, does not require any justification for its existence. We have degraded, we're instrumental in degrading heavily the biosphere. For me, rewilding some substantial tracts of nature is simply what needs to be done to restore the biosphere.
So we do it for nature in her own right?
Yes. Now, there are some utilitarian reasons why we should. I mean, it can benefit things indirectly, but ultimately for me, this is really off the point. That is correct.
So if we're going to make big new spaces for nature, and we've got a large population already, I guess you're accepting the trend of moving people into giant cities.
The implication of moving people into, it sounds like we are hurting them or really relocating people. I'm not advocating this. There's a number of things which are relevant. First, there are some regions which are fairly sparsely populated, so there's no need to move anyone too much anywhere, really. Number two, this is a whole subject by itself, I am calling for bringing our population numbers down, which has obvious direct bearing on the issue here. Every region has a separate answer. There is no one simple universal answer. But nonetheless, the reduction of population numbers, the existing regions which are not heavily populated, all lend themselves for rewilding.
All right. Well, I don't want to dive into a great long discussion, but can you give us a glimpse of what your population solution would be?
First, let's talk about targets. Long story short, I'm calling for a target of 1 billion people. At the moment, we are at 7 billion people. Once again, I crunched the numbers looking at existing fertility rates, looking at life tables of almost every country, and it comes down to the following. If we go to a two-child policy where the vast majority of people will not have more than 2 kids, so no kids, 1 kid or 2 kids, we will get to 1 billion people within about 150 years.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with our guest, author Daniel Reardon. His new book is The Blueprint, Averting Global Collapse. Daniel, there isn't going to be a future for most of the Earth's current species unless we can avert a major climate shift. What are your large-scale ideas about how to do that?
I guess it comes down to two. The shift to... Actually, let's say it in one. The shift to a negative carbon economy, so versus neutral, it is no longer enough just to stop emitting. This would be the equivalent of letting go of the gas pedal, but we still have momentum, which will hurl us over the cliff. We need to brake, which basically means, one, to stop emitting greenhouse gases as much as technologically as possible. Two, to capture and bring down basically 300 billion tons of carbon between now and 2100. This can be done in a number of ways. The prime way is using direct air capture carbon machine. And as you guessed it, I also crunched some numbers there.
And how does it look? I mean, does this technology exist?
Yes, it does. In a very, let's say, prototype have been built. I'm using it as a model, but it's not necessarily the only one. A technology which has been developed by Kilimanjaro Energy. They have created kind of panels that basically the air moving through those panels, almost like furnace filters, capture the carbon. Then you wash off the panels, you get the carbon, and then once again, you put them back up there to capture more carbon. Okay, I'll give you a bottom line. In order to capture 30 billion tons of CO2 every year, it comes to an area of a few hundred square kilometers worth of installations, with about 8 million of those machines. They would require an astounding amount of electricity, but once again, it can be done using the energy scheme I proposed. This kind of a volume is really what it takes to bring the carbon down and the avert the worst.
Yeah, right now we have an economy that rewards carbon production, and from what I'm hearing from you, we'll have to turn that on its head and reward carbon sequestration. Is that what you're seeing?
Well, you know, when I started to write the book, it was meant to be just technological in nature. Basically, here's the technologies in transportation or energy and so on that we need. This is what it takes. Then I realized fairly quickly that none of it is really going to happen under the existing economic and political setup. Then I started to look at what would it take. What would it take is nothing short of a complete makeover, a complete transformation of our economic setup and political setup.
Well, I think our listeners can agree there are pathways out and they can see goals we need to reach. But as you told me yourself in an email, sooner or later people bail out. They say, well, that isn't the way the world works now. Our economy's crashing, our political system's broken or corrupt. So how do we handle that?
We build a new setup. Of course, it's much easier said than done, but that's really what would it take. I don't think there's anyone out there who sincerely believe that under the existing way of doing politics and economy, something fundamental will take place. If it could have, it would have by now. So it's, of course, a whole discussion, but basically it has to be something different because what we have right now is not going to cut it.
And I'm wondering if you shouldn't add more about the global economic Ponzi scheme to your blueprint. We accuse economists of leaving out the environment. I mean, governments and most of the population are bankrupt just when we need to make these major changes that you're proposing. So shouldn't Greens be realistic about the developing economic crisis and how that affects our options for change?
Obviously, that's the most basic thing. If I may, I gave some big statements about the need to a complete transformation. If I may, I will give just one concrete example that I proposed. I propose to institute what I would call a ecological footprint tag to every product and service we generate. The environmental footprint tag will basically assess throughout the life cycle of a given product what is the ecological footprint of this product, whether it means in terms of greenhouse gas emissions during the production, whether it means water it consumes, whether it means the earth being disturbed. There's about 5 broad parameters, which are in turn divided to many subcategories. Now, that's the interesting part. Once we get a fairly good sense of how much water we can consume, how many trees we can harvest sustainably, we can allocate these resources annually among all the people of the world. So what I'm talking in effect is a system of quota where your virtual account will be credited monthly with a footprint credit. So when you go and purchase a product, not only is the money, which is a consideration, but also how much footprint units would it cost. This one measure right there can change the entire thrust of the economy from manufacturing things that may be obscene, ecologically speaking, to having the manufacturers attempting to produce things which have the least amount of footprint impact, or else people simply won't buy it. So this is the one measure I propose among a number.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with our guest, author Daniel Reardon. His new book is The Blueprint, Averting Global Collapse. We'll be right back in just a minute with more Radio EcoShock.